Good morning, all. First case on our schedule this morning is that of Tim Berry and others versus William Crawford and others. This is a civil transfer case. Emergency transfer has been granted to this court, and each side has been allotted 20 minutes to argue. Appearing for the appellant, we have Thomas Fisher, solicitor of the state of Indiana, assisted by Ashley Harwell. Thank you. And for the appellees, Mark Giaquinta is principal counsel, and assisted by George Blues and Holly Breed. Thank you all. We're looking forward to this. You may begin. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about hardball politics, pure and simple. In 2011 and again in 2012, the House Minority Caucus concluded that their only effective legislative strategy was to disrupt all House business by walking out. In turn, the House Majority Caucus, when negotiations for return failed, concluded that their only effective response was to levy escalating fines on those who were absent. When those fines and deductions from members' disbursements to satisfy those fines began to really hit home, the Democrats ran to court. Again and again and again, they went back to the same judge, even when they were assigned a new judge, seeking shelter from the political fray, and at every turn, that judge acceded to their demands, effectively making his court, rather than the ballot box, the arbiter of fair politics. For this court, therefore, the central question here is whether to leave the legislature alone to work out its own political disputes, or whether instead to permit Indiana's courts to become players in the political game. This court's precedents, as well as the text of the Indiana Constitution, all point in the direction of judicial forbearance here, and in deference to the legislative branch and each house to manage its own affairs. Article 4, in various sections, including 10, which authorizes the House to determine its own rules. Section 11, which authorizes the House to compel the attendance of members. Section 14, which authorizes the House to punish members for disorderly behavior. And Section 16, which is a plenary grant of authority of all powers necessary for a legislative department in a free and independent state to conduct its affairs, all support the House's sole authority to levy and collect fines on members.
Is it your position that under no circumstances or virtually no circumstances would you ask us to play? Is this always going to be a situation where the legislature should be free to create, impose its own rules? When if at all, you're suggesting that we shouldn't be involved in this at all, correct?
Right, and I think that is a fair reading of Massario. Now, let's take a look at a couple of other doctrines, or at least one other doctrine, where the court has said
it. My question is, if you can get to, is it unlimited, or do you concede that there
is? I think that you could read Massario and you could look at the precedents and decide that it is. However, I want to make 2 points in response to that. The first one is, this court has issued a blanket doctrine of called the Enrolled Act Doctrine, that it's not going to look behind enactments to see if a quorum was present, to see if all the votes were properly tabulated. As long as the signatures of the officials, proper officials, are on the bills as enacted, the court will treat them as properly enacted. That's significant for this question, because in this court's precedents, it has acknowledged the possibility that there could be extreme circumstances where that immunity to litigation could theoretically generate what we would think of as unacceptable consequences. We cite to the court to the Rocheline case, which is one of the more recent precedents on the Enrolled Act.
So, excuse me. So, as I take it in your response to Justice David, that it is not a blanket, the court has no authority. You're suggesting that there are circumstances when it could.
Well, let me get. I'll cut to the chase. I think that if the court is uncomfortable with the idea that that it's under no circumstances could it ever intercede, the only theoretical limit I could conceive of is to ask, is this a typical type of form of compulsion or form of sanction for a house of representative government? And clearly it is. Even in Powell versus McCormick, which...
Well, in all due respect, at stake here, isn't it? Not so much whether the legislature or the House, has the authority to impose fine. The question in this case, as I understand it, is whether it has the authority to withhold wages in collection of the fine. So this is more like a collection case, isn't it, than challenging the House's authority to impose the fine. Is that a fair characterization of where we are here?
First of all, I'm not sure the plaintiffs concede away the...
Well, yeah,
the
but first, take it... Let's assume for the sake of argument that this is not an issue about whether the House has the authority. The question is, do they have to impose the fine? The question is the collection.
Well, okay. So even in that question, I think that the Article 3 limitation that the court recognized in Massario applies. Massario, let's not forget, was about a statute. It was about access to public records under a state statute. And the court said, even though the legislature may seem to have authorized the courts to have interceded in this matter to enforce the Access to Public Records Act, that is not something that we can do. So applying that logic here, even if the legislature seems to have enacted legislation that regulates the collections of fines, the court cannot enforce that against the legislature. That is the lesson of Massario. Now, I do also want to make another example from history, if I may. Powell versus McCormick. Adam Clayton Powell was not only not seated originally, he was also fined. The review of that case by the Supreme Court had only to do with barring him from taking his seat. He was fined $25,000, and that fine was collected from his paycheck. It was deducted from his paycheck. That is part of legislative history, part of what legislatures do.
But that didn't preclude the Supreme Court from hearing the case in the first instance. I mean, that's the piece I'm having. I'm not quite clear on where you're on this. I mean, your argument would seem to be that under Powell or any other construction, that these courts have no business and no authority in this area whatsoever.
That, and I think that Powell, you know, is a circumstance that we can set aside, because there we're not talking about the internal operation so much as we're talking about the House's authority to create extra constitutional qualifications. Interestingly, the Supreme Court in that case acknowledged that if they had admitted Powell, if they had seated him, and then had mustered the two-thirds or three-quarters majority, whichever it is, to expel him, they may not have had jurisdiction to review that, because expulsion is an open-ended concept. The problem with Powell was you had a distinct set of constitutional qualifications that clashed against what the House was doing. Here, what we have is an open-ended authority to have rules, to compel attendance, and the rules themselves specifically say and have said ever since 1851 that the House can fine members for being absent. So this is not an unusual circumstance. Now, the court...
I have a question. When you look at the subject matter jurisdiction, how do you look at the legislative bolting where the legislature said we were going to file in Marion County an action to collect fines?
Right.
So with due process requirements, there's standard of review or the burden of proof is preponderance of evidence. That seems to cut against your arguments today.
If I thought that statute was constitutional, it would. I think that statute cannot be enforced, precisely for the reasons I'm telling you, and precisely for the reasons set forth by Massari.
So you're saying the statute, the legislative bolting statute, is unconstitutional as part of your argument?
Well, the court need not reach it. I'm saying that the principle that I'm advocating and the principle set forth by Massario implies the unconstitutionality of that remedial procedure. Massario says even if the legislature authorizes the courts to grant a remedy to regulate the internal affairs of the legislature, the courts can't enforce it.
So there is no limit on what collection power the legislature has with regard to collecting fines. If they want to go seize a car, if they want to seize bank accounts, even maybe a joint bank account where there was one member of the House and one non-member, they can?
It is not the province of the judiciary to review that case. But again, I want to...
Is there any limit to the collection power? when you look at other, like the wage statutes, the fining statutes, is there any limit to the ability to collect a fine?
No, I don't think there is, not as far as what the judiciary can enact. Now, let me take the court back to its precedents to explain why that shouldn't bother the court.
And when you do that,
yes,
would you also address whether it is limited to just fines? Because if I'm hearing you correctly, it would flow logically that the majority party could say, if you don't vote our way, we're going to impose some limitation or some accountability or some fine. So address that. I'm really concerned about where the limit is.
Okay. Well, I think the first limit that the court could embrace if it thought it necessary is to say, is this a traditional type of internal management response, which fines, levying fines, collecting them clearly is. If there's some set of actions that may lie well outside of things like censure and fine and reprimand that are the typical responses to disciplinary problems within a legislative branch, you know, that can be a separate set of consequences. But let me go back to the court's enrolled act doctrine cases. Rocheline cites a prior case that called Evans versus Brown from 1869, which, as it happens, came on the heel of a walkout. In that case, the court acknowledged that it was not going to look behind whether there was, in fact, a quorum established sufficient to pass a bill. And the court acknowledged, you know what, it may be possible that you could have the officials of each house conspiring to approve legislation that was never introduced and never passed. We understand that this can be abused. But because we are a coordinate branch of government, we trust the legislature to stay within its authority. We do not presume that that House is going to act beyond its authority as a way to come up with a reason to review its actions. So this Court has already long past considered the possibility that matters of legislative of prerogative can be abused, but has entrusted the legislature not to abuse it anyway. That is the soul of the Enrolled Act Doctrine.
Well, let me ask a question, I probably paraphrasing something the trial court seemed to have alluded to, and this is the notion that would the trial court have jurisdiction to intervene to stop burning down of the plaintiff's home as a form of house discipline? Would they have any authority to do that?
My first response is that if someone were intent on burning down the houses, with all due respect to the judiciary, I'm not sure that a judicial response would be sufficient in that circumstance. But the point, the larger point.
But you get the point. It's how far do you push, and it gets back to questions we've all been asking this morning.
Yeah.
How far do you push the non-intervention of the court based upon the conduct of the General Assembly?
Again, I think that if the court is uncomfortable with an unlimited doctrine, it could conceive of a doctrine. It wouldn't apply in this case, but in a later case where, if what is before the court is something that is not typical of a proper response within a legislative house, that could be something that may be a different
question. But what's typicality? I mean, what does that mean? I mean,
well, I think
if something happens once, is that typical? If it happens twice, maybe. If it happens for the first time, I mean, that's sort of a slippery slope, non-very well-defined approach to jurisprudence.
Well, I think, with respect, Your Honor, I think that the legislative responses to absences and other actions that disrupt house business is fairly well established over time.
And again, not the imposition of the fine.
I understand.
For my purposes, I concede that your opponents have not conceded that point. But just for the sake of this argument, let's put aside for the moment the authority and the ability to impose a fine for discipline. It's the collection piece that still bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
And how far, again, can the court go in saying there's some things you can or cannot do, and we have judicial oversight of that?
Well, the collection of the fines itself is also, I think, well enough established. As, again, Powell case is one of those. Now, even going back to colonial times, pre-Constitution, there's I think if you review the history there's a book by a woman named Mary Patterson Clark called Parliamentary Privilege in the American Colonies. And she writes about detailed circumstances where parliaments and legislatures of the colonies have levied fines in circumstances including New Hampshire, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, South Carolina, and detailed at least one circumstance where when the fine wasn't paid, they went out and seized the property of the legislator. This is not new. This is something that, that legislatures have done over the centuries to maintain discipline without interference of the judiciary. Now, I don't want to suggest to you that this is a completely uncheckered past. I think if you look back at the details of Parliament in Britain, and if you look at even the colonial legislatures, you'll see a lot of back and forth between legislatures and legislative houses as to who has the upper hand in these things. But as things have sorted out, and as this court has struggled with our own Constitution and has come to the conclusion about the judiciary's role in Indiana, it's clear that this court has been comfortable deferring to the legislature, at least in traditional and typical matters of House judgment, which is exactly what this is.
Let's assume, just for the sake of discussion, that the court takes a different view and says, well, we think that there is some role for the judiciary, so the trial court could hear this matter. Then where are we? The trial court entered an order enjoining the collection of any future, as I understand, any future fines, and an order requiring the refund of fines already imposed. Where are we on the sort of the substantive part of this? If we say that the trial court has the authority and this court has the authority to review, what about the injunction itself?
Well, we have elucidated substantial arguments in our briefs as to why the Wage Payment Act and the various statutes invoked by the plaintiffs do not apply to the legislature, to the state of Indiana, why we don't have a situation here of setting fines against salaries or against wages, but only against expense reimbursements, which is what per diems are, and why, in fact, House members themselves should not be deemed employees. Beyond that, there's also the issue of sovereign immunity, which I think precludes the payment of any fines already collected.
But the record at the trial court has not really been developed, correct? I mean, this is part of the problem here is that we're taking this on interlocutory appeal, so we don't have a good record about all these various elements of injunction and prevailing on the merits and all that kind of stuff.
I agree. And it was a surprise when we got a final judgment in the end without any opportunity to create a record. On the other hand, I think our arguments are sufficient enough to preclude any further proceedings, even on the merits of the statutory claims.
I have one more quick question.
Sure.
So is it your position that when it comes to the legislature collecting fines, they do not have to follow any other Indiana law?
They follow their own levy, their own determination. Now, that I think also implicates limits, as we were discussing earlier, on what processes they can use to collect those fines. So they can use their internal mechanisms, which is what happened here. Resorting to the judiciary, however, is a different matter. Thank you,
Mr. Giacquita.
May it please the court. First, an administrative matter. We have indicated in our brief that there was no other case we could find other than Powell versus McCormick involving the seizure of legislative pay. We found recently 14 Atlantic 3rd 766 from 2011. The facts are not nearly as similar to this case as Powell versus McCormick, because the seizure took place as an ultra-virus act by the Speaker of the House, the court did entertain the case. We thought that the court might find it useful in its determination.
Mr. Giacquino, your clients all basically voted unanimously to adopt the House rules that grant the power to impose a fine, did they not?
I believe so,
Justice. And does the power to impose, does that not also imply then a power to collect?
And that's at the crux of this case. At what point does the power invested in one branch of government usurp the powers of the other? And it's our position, and we did not appeal the issue of the imposition of the fine, that when competing constitutional rights clash, it is the role of the courts to step in and arbitrate or perform what Justice Brennan described in Baker versus Carr as that delicate exercise in constitutional interpretation, especially when determining when a matter has been constitutionally committed exclusively to a coordinate branch of government. So while the legislature may enact rules when the carrying out of those rules exceeds the constitutional commitment of a matter to that branch, it's the responsibility of the courts, and one of the most recognized and I think important roles of the judiciary in our system of government, to step in order to determine the limits of that constitutionally committed power. The questions here today, I've been advised by co-counsel not to start telling stories, and so I'm going to resist that. But your questions here today are uncanny in their similarity to the oral argument in Powell versus McCormick, when Justice Black asked Judge Bromley, is there no limit then to the legislative authority in this regard? And Judge Bromley's answer, well, were we to bring the president to the well of Congress to behead him, then you could invoke the scandal doctrine and stop us. Adam Clayton Powell's son told me that the court recoiled when they heard that, but the court was flummoxed by the lack of limitation, because dating back to Marbury versus Madison, it's the fundamental role of the courts to step in such instances. And we concede that our citizen legislators are politicians. We can't deny that the dispute.
So if we agree with you, your argument is that we're employees, so therefore the wage payment statute doesn't apply.
Yes, sir.
And are you of the same opinion that the bolting statute is unconstitutional and therefore the individual members that are fined can't be sued and get attorneys and the presiding person get attorney's fees and I think there's a penalty and all that money goes to the general fund? Are you of the opinion that's the course of action, or do you concede that it is nothing more than a collection case and the members would be on their own in whatever respective courts they were sued, but you just can't take it out of our per diem, which we believe is really compensation?
First of all, I didn't come here to defend the constitutionality of the anti-bolting statute. I heard for the very first time that it's considered unconstitutional.
You'd probably concede that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, I would say, Justice David, this is the first point I'd like to make is that the anti-bolting statute would have no applicability to the failure to pay my clients their per diem while they were in their caucus in Illinois, because that per diem was never and has never been related to a matter of house discipline. That per diem that was not paid while they were in Illinois was, as we found out for the first time in their brief, not paid because they were of the opinion that they were in recess for 5 days, and therefore the business per diem was not owed.
Well, part of the problem with that argument, however, is that we don't have a trial record on these disputed facts, correct? I mean, that's something that, if at all, would have to be resolved in some other proceeding. That's disputed. Is it not? I mean, it's raised in a brief, and you counter it with another argument, but the trial court was never in a position to resolve that because of the nature of the procedural posture of this case, correct?
Justice Rucker, on the point of the per diem that was not paid while they were in Illinois, we submitted the record of the House Journal. So it's ironic that the Enrolled Act Doctrine has come up here, because we presented the House Journal showing that they weren't in recess. But what has never been addressed and has not been disputed, and unless I hear in the remaining minutes on rebuttal, I've never heard that they dispute that if the business per diem is not owed, the subsistence per diem is. They acknowledge that in their brief. So that issue is unrelated to house discipline and would be unrelated to the bolting.
You're going back to the imposition of the fine, and you started off your section in talking about, we're not talking about the imposition of fine, we're talking about the collection of the fine. So the trial court found that he didn't go back in and look at the imposition of the fine, he looked at the collection of the fine with regard to the injunctive relief. Aren't you asking us to go back behind even that order by having us look at what was fined or not fined?
No, because they've conceded that the failure to pay the per diem while they were in Illinois was not a fine. That's not a fine issue. And that's critical that I make that point, because we apparently didn't make it well enough in our brief. The money that they didn't get when they were in Illinois is unrelated to fines. That was just clerk spots not putting their names on the voucher. They've never argued that that money was fined. They've said it wasn't paid because they were in recess. And we submitted, going back to your comment, Justice Recker, we submitted the House record to show that there was no recess. But even if there was, if they were in recess, they get the, this is all House Bill 1001 language. They get one form of per diem or another every day of the year. And that's unrelated to fines, Justice Rush. So, no, we're not going back and asking you to referee the imposition of the fines. We agree that this case is about the seizure of our clients' constitutionally guaranteed, their constitutional guarantee to be secure in their property.
What way would you, how should they collect the fines then? If you think that the way that they collect them was unconstitutional, how would you propose that your clients pay the fines?
Well, I would propose that they follow the same statutory procedure in collecting a fine that any other employer would follow, that the fine would be reduced to a, well, I would, let me go back, I apologize. I would propose that they use the process they included in their second motion. They, in their second motion for fine, suggested that they be empowered to hire an attorney, reduce the fines to a judgment, and collect them. That was in their motion. They just didn't do it.
The problem I have with your approach to that is now we are getting into the internal workings of the legislature. You mentioned that a lot in your brief about the various the House rules and they filed a motion, et cetera, et cetera. And speaking as a majority of one, that is the very thing that, in my view, is an internal matter that we that would perhaps be the area where this court has is limited in reviewing. So getting back to Justice Rush's question, aside from the internal House rules being followed, what statutory, common law, how would they collect the fines, assuming they had the authority to impose the fines, how would you suggest they be collected?
The problem with this is there has never been an attempt to collect fines, but if they were to decide to collect the fines, my suggestion would be that they do it in a manner that respects our client's constitutional right to be secure in their property. And this court in Branham and in other cases has already established that the way to do that is to take the fine. The question of the fine would already have been established, but the amount would be collected through the judicial process of garnishment.
So so basically you reduce it to a judgment?
Correct.
And you go to court?
Correct.
And then it's reduced to judgment and the wages are garnished?
Correct.
How is that materially different from what happened here? That is to say, we end up at the same place. We are garnishing, as it were, your per diem to satisfy the fine. Now, it's a shortcut, but how is it materially different from what you just conceded would be the proper procedure to take?
Well, in the first instance, it allows the court to play some role in affording my clients, who are citizen legislators, some modicum of due process, which this procedure doesn't allow.
Wouldn't you be elevating form over substance? I mean, wouldn't that be elevating form over substance? You conceded that it could be garnished. How would this be any different, I guess? If let's assume that we pursue the garnishment approach. In the end, how would the result be any different than the result here?
Well, because the garnishment statute does include various protections for private citizens with respect to amounts excluded, in the availability of the funds to be taken, the timing in which they're taken. This process, which was without any limit whatsoever, was such that my clients had no ability to plan for this. they may come to court in such a situation and do what any judgment creditor may do. They may claim that they had no notice of the fine. Raise some other constant.
Aren't you kind of treading back into, we're not here to talk about the imposition, but we want your help so that later we can talk about the imposition in a different form, right?
Right. And so the question then becomes, are there constitutional limits on the collection, on the seizure, that our collection process protects? And my clients are asking for all of those constitutional protections that arise when collections occur as established by our laws. And I would say that by going that route, there is no question in that the constitutionally protected right to the compensation under Article 4, Section 29 in the House bill would have been violated. I mean, when we get back to the question here, it's the role of the courts to be open to my clients as citizens of the state, and the mechanism chosen by the majority here recognize neither the rights my clients have nor the role of the courts to arbitrate those rights. So getting back to the distinction, the real problem is that if they are not required to use the procedures outlined in the garnishment statute, we're left with an unlimited right to seize wage. And if that's what we're left with, it could be 20% of the per diem today. It could be the full amount tomorrow. There is no limit. And those are the key constitutional constraints the statutes provide in the normal course of collecting a debt.
Mr. Giaquinta, am I correct that in this case there was no attempt to collect the fines by attachment or garnishment of salary, but only attachment or confiscation or holding back the per diem expense reimbursement?
That is correct. But the per diem in this case, Justice Dixon, is in fact wage, and we address that in our brief. It's called per diem, but our clients are entitled to it, whether they're lying on a beach in Barbados or cutting their grass at home on the weekends or in the legislature. So it was not taken out of the twice paid salary. It was confiscated from their weekly per diem check.
And is it correct that the appellees are not asserting any issues on cross appeal?
That is correct, Chief Justice Dixon. I want to address the fact that while we are subsumed, and it's appropriate that we are, on this issue of fines and the limit of fines, again, there are two elements of my client's case that were unrelated to the imposition of fines or any other House rule. That is their retirement benefit and this per diem amount that they did not receive when they were in caucus in Illinois. It's interesting to note that the justification for the failure to pay their retirement benefit on the amount seized from their paychecks indicates some reduction in pay. We just want to remind the court respectfully that that deprivation is included as wage under their statutory right to their wages, and it is calculated on gross income. Their gross incomes were reduced as a result of the seizure, but it should never have reduced the amount they were entitled to under their retirement benefits, nor should they have been deprived their retirement benefit on the per diem they did not receive when they were in Illinois. And this accounts for roughly two-thirds of the deprivation. So while we feel strongly that there is no constitutional commitment to the legislature to seize property, we want to respectfully remind the court that two-thirds of our case lies outside the scope of any commitment to the legislature whatsoever and lies outside any concern over the enrolled House doctrine or the Enrolled Act doctrine, because there was no legislative action taken to deprive them of that amount. They just weren't paid.
Excuse me just a second. Is it necessary that this court reach any of the constitutional issues on the merits, not on the review process? Was there any reason for this court to reach constitutional issues, or can it be resolved based upon statutory interpretation?
If our clients' rights are enforced under the Wage Payment Act, that's clearly avoids the issue of whether or not they have a constitutional right of action for civil damages under Article 4, Section 29 of the Constitution. But there is, I think, very little way to avoid the constitutional issue of the constitutional ramifications of the jurisdiction question. Because until this court determines that the issue of these deprivations is subject to judicial review, until this court decides that Judge Dreyer made the right call when he crafted the line between what he deemed had been committed to the legislature, that is the imposition of the fines, and their seizure, we really don't get into the court to have that discussion. So at the outset, we ask this court to take on the task of determining whether or not this matter of seizure was in the first instance committed to a coordinate branch of government. And we suggest that the best way of doing that is the use of the political doctrine, the political question doctrine, as articulated in Baker versus Carr and Powell versus McCormick. And I do want to point out that the back pay issue in Powell versus McCormick was in fact remanded to the district court. It was not dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, as was requested by Judge Bromley. As a matter of fact, even Justice Stewart in his dissent, and that's a very important part of the case, because Justice Stewart finds a home for Adam Clayton Powell's back pay and fine issue in the Court of Claims, citing another case, Alejandrino versus Kazan. This is the first time this has ever happened in the history of our state. One of the first times, we think, in the history of our nation. And we think that it's a key opportunity for this court to fill out what has been decided in other cases dealing with its jurisdiction by adopting the Powell versus McCormick framework for determining that key question of whether or not there's a textually demonstrable constitutional commitment to a coordinate branch of government that would deprive this court of taking and exercising its role in this dispute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Giaquinta. Mr. Fisher, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, let me address this per diem issue, the idea that the minority caucus legislators who walked out were not paid their per diem. That is as a result of the Budget Act, which says that in order to be paid per diem after 5 session days of recess, you have to submit a voucher. You can get paid, you just have to submit a voucher. You have to come in and submit the voucher. There's been no allegation that any of the legislators who claim to be deprived of per diem for that period actually submitted such a voucher. Now, the idea of going back and examining and second-guessing the legislature as to whether they were in recess during that period, I think brings forth a lot of the problems that are associated with judicial review of internal legislative matters. I think what Mr. Giaquinta appears to be contemplating with a remand is this idea that we would somehow start deposing various legislators who were engaged in the walkout. What were they doing? And then what about deposing the members of the House Majority Caucus? What is their view of what is a recess? What is the what was going on in the chamber at the time. This kind of spectacle of judicial rummaging around in the back rooms and in the deal-making and in the conversations of legislators is exactly what Massario was trying to avoid and exactly what separation of powers suggests should not happen. But it's a, just to complete the thought, however, with regard to the per diem, it is not the case that per diem has to be paid in a subsistence level when the 5 days of recess are up. You have to submit the voucher, and if you submit the voucher, you get the full session per diem. The budget bill is quite explicit on that, and we walk through that in the briefs. I think the other problem with leaving this to the judiciary to resolve is that it contemplates, I think, Justice David, as you were suggesting, only a different forum for fighting about whether the fine can be levied at all. The only point I could see of having a garnishment proceeding would be for a judge to evaluate whether the fines were properly levied and to dictate to the legislature how it can go about doing its job in that regard. Now, there isn't any factual dispute, as I understand it, about the idea that you know, the allegations of the fine instrument and the impact of the imposition of the fines, there isn't anything to be resolved by a separate garnishment hearing. The legislators who were involved here all had an ability to plan. They were all notified that they were going to be fined and that the fines would be deducted. This was not a mystery. This happened in 2011, and there was no lawsuit even tried to prevent that. The lawsuit that first came along was after the fact of deduction. The lawsuit that sought an injunction came the next session when the fines were ratcheted up from $350 to $1,000, and it suddenly started to hit home. The way to plan for that, of course, number one, was to come back and participate and do the job that they were elected to do. No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Giaquinas, gentlemen, we appreciate the presentation today. But we'll now take this matter. Mr. Fisher, you opened your argument by saying that this case is about hardball politics. Courts are not a political institution, and if it would be at all possible for the political parties in Indiana to set a national example of cooperation, this might be an ideal opportunity for you both sides to get their heads together and resolve this matter by compromise, and we encourage that to be considered. Thank you.
All rise.